Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Tine Janolu. I studied neuroscience and then bioengineering, graduating with a PhD from ETH Zurich in Switzerland. Currently, I'm working in the diagnostics industry. Today, I have with me Lucy Cook to talk about her new book, Bitch, A Revolutionary Guide to Sex, Evolution, and the Female Animal. In the last few decades, a revolution has been brewing in zoology and evolutionary biology. Lucy Cook introduces us to a riotous cast of animals and the scientists studying them that are redefining the female of species. The bitches in Bitch overturn outdated binary expectations of bodies, brains, biology, and behavior. Lucy Cook's brilliant new book will change how you think about sex, sexual identity, and sexuality in animals, and also the very forces that shape evolution. Lucy Cook is a New York Times bestselling author, award-winning filmmaker, and National Geographic explorer with a master's in zoology from Oxford University, where she was taught by Richard Dawkins. She loves travel and adventure and has a soft spot for some of the planet's strangest and most misunderstood animals. As well as writing books, Lucy is also an accomplished photographer, filmmaker, and broadcaster who has produced and presenter of award-winning natural history documentaries for BBC, National Geographic, Discovery, PBS, and many more. Lucy, great to have you here.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Before we dive into the many interesting themes you explore in the book, can you talk a little bit about what motivated you to write this book?
Well, that's a great opening question, because I was motivated by what I was taught at university when I studied zoology in the end of the 80s by Richard Dawkins, in fact. That it didn't chime with me. It didn't make a lot of sense. I was taught that females were passive, sort of second-rate players in the story of evolution, and you know, that there's this sort of fundamental universal law, which is that because males produce lots of cheap mobile sperm and females produce just a few amount of eggs, that somehow we'd drawn the short straw in the lottery of life and we were doomed to pay second fiddle to the sperm shooters for all eternity, because they just because of the difference in gamete size meant that males would be promiscuous and dominant and females would be coy and chaste, and it was a very dispiriting message to be taught, and so it stayed with me, and then over the years I've realized that isn't the case. So it seemed to me that this would be a great subject for a book.
And indeed, it is. I mean, I also really appreciated the language that you made, the scientific studies and concepts very, very much accessible to everybody, in fact. And I personally actually laughed out loud, I don't know how many times, while reading the book. So it was really entertaining as well as scientifically educating. So thanks a lot.
Oh, that's great that you think that, because my intention is to write things that are scientifically rigorous. I mean, my source material for this book were scientific journals. It wasn't even other books, let alone it was scientific journals, and they can be a little dry. The information they contain is extraordinary, but so my aim is to write in a way that reaches the widest possible audience, and humor's a good way of smuggling in learning, I think.
Definitely, definitely worked in my case. So let's then start with one of the themes that you talk about in the book. You call it scientific phallocracy. What does this mean?
Well, it's just that science has been dominated, or certainly the science of evolutionary biology has been dominated by men. And you know, science is all about asking questions, you know, and one tends to ask questions that are relevant to you, you know, and you're, so the fact that science has been evolutionary biology has been dominated by men means that it's skewed the perspective. It means that questions have been asked from a male perspective, and you know, quite understandably, great male scientists not necessarily interested in you know, the contribution of mothers to the evolutionary process, you know, because it's not where their interest lies. You know, they're interested in looking at their own reflections. So it's this sort of domination of male domination of science has skewed the way that we view the female animal. So that's what I mean by the scientific phallocracy.
And how did it influence the whole study? You already have mentioned a little bit, like certain parts are ignored. How did this scientific phallocracy then for so many years dominated the field and basically obscured in some way how females and basically also beyond binary animals and different sexualities were ignored for so long?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's because it's, you know, to be honest with you, and it pains me to have to say this, but Darwin is largely to blame, basically, because, you know, Darwin, one of the greatest scientists of all time, you know, his theory of evolution by natural selection is one of the greatest theories in science still. I mean, you know, and he is my hero. I studied evolutionary biology and I'm inspired by Darwin. But the fact is that, you know, he was a Victorian man, and what's extraordinary to me was how much cultural bias had infiltrated his science. And you know, that even someone who's as meticulous and brilliant a scientist as Darwin is not immune to the stranglehold of cultural bias. And so when he wrote his second great theoretical masterpiece, which is The Descent of Man and Selection in Relation to Sex, which attempted to define the sexes, he was swayed by Victorian culture. And so the female animal came out marginalized and misunderstood, like a Victorian housewife. And you know, to a certain extent, a lot of the things that he wrote about, I'm not even sure he even entirely really in his heart of hearts believe, but I think probably for Darwin, having caused so much controversy with his first theory of evolution by natural selection and the church having been so angry, he probably felt there was enough controversy in one lifetime. So he did toe the line, and female animals were depicted as passive, coy and chaste, you know, as was seemly, as seemly for a female. Males were dominant in Victorian society, so that's how he portrayed them. But of course, Darwin carries a huge amount of influence. He's a genius. And so because of him saying this, it meant that for decades, scientists that followed in his wake suffered from confirmation bias. And so they just saw the passive female prototype and looked for evidence of that. And anything that was contrary to that was dismissed as an inconvenient anomaly.
Yeah, and you mention it also at the end, and it comes across, I mean, in the many chapters when you explore various themes. I personally, you know, having studied science, couldn't believe that people would, you know, Darwin, starting from Darwin, and then afterwards, the observations, scientific data. You have to believe when you study science that science is objective, and you interpret the data, obviously, but you still control your experiments and so on. So it cannot. So I was very shocked to see how much of these, you know, belief systems and values and everything was projected into the interpretation of science. This is really unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, me too. I mean, you know, it's the problem with paradigms, isn't it? You know, that they, they restrict the view of sort of blue sky thinking, really. Mm-hmm. And you know, this, I mean, you know, there's a great example in the book is, you know, and is from the is the gosh, what's the bird? The bird that's the Marsluff and Balder and opinion jays. That's it. So the opinion jay experiment is a great example that I have in the introduction, which is, you know, it's a social bird, flocks in large numbers. The scientists who study it, who are exemplary scientists, the experts in pinion jays in the 1980s wrote a book about it where they were looking for the dominance network in this social species and you know, assumed, went looking for the alpha male. And when they couldn't find any aggression in males, they tried baiting the animals and with sort of treats and you know, to try and incite some sort of territorial war, and they were unable to do this. And they ended up having to sort of base their experiments on what amounted to birds giving each other dirty looks, which was like extraordinary. But they, meticulously, because they were great scientists, they recorded all the data, and every time they saw one of these annoyed looks, they diligently record it. And of course, they had seen aggressive behavior, which they'd also recorded, which, you know, violent attacks of birds midair, but none of this made it into their dominance network because all the birds involved were female and not male. And they wrote off this female aggression as being an avian version of premenstrual PMS, pre-breeding syndrome, they called it. So, you know, it's just sort of dismissed, a classic thing, females and their messy hormones, sweep that to one side. You know, so, you know, this isn't a conspiracy. This is just blinkered science. And I, you know, there are many examples of this where, you know, it's the paradigm that is constricting the view, basically. And these are great scientists, but they're just behaving in a blinkered way.
Yeah, and such a shame. I mean, and at the same time, it's quite nice to see there are so many others who are trying to turn this around. So you also mention so many scientists that kind of try to understand how female reproduction works, how it develops, how what are the roles of females in communities of animals, and basically they do occupy many, many different roles, right? So there are communities where there's female dominance, for example.
Exactly. I mean, you know, that's the thing, is I think what I wanted to sort of showcase with the book is, I'm not trying to say that females are more dominant than males, and, you know, I'm just saying that there's a huge variety, and actually you just can't pigeonhole females in this one sort of passive stereotype, that actually all these different systems exist because, you know, for lots of different reasons. And it was really fun for me to experiencing and investigating, and there's just this glorious diversity that exists out there.
So I was also curious about, you mentioned one of the topics you go into is the female choice. So this is actually something that Darwin even tried to get it right, but as you said, a little bit discouraged from it. You mention it as the mad aunt in the evolutionary ethic of Darwinian theory. So can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, so, you know, Darwin actually, you know, he said that his theory of sexual selection, which is that there was the follow-up to natural selection, and it seeks to explain the differences between the sexes and focuses on those. And he sees that sexual selection is driven by two forces, male competition for mates and then female choice. And he's absolutely right. Those forces do shape evolution. But there are, it's just there's a lot more to it than that. But the fact that he'd given females this agency in choice was incredibly heretical at the time, because the reality of that is that female choice is shaping the evolution of males. And this was not something that went down very well in Victorian England. And in fact, Alfred Russel Wallace, who was the co-author of The Theory of Evolution by Natural Selection, became its greatest detractor. But, you know, Darwin was absolutely right. Female choice is responsible for some of the most whimsical and extraordinary traits in nature. I mean, if you see something that's extraordinarily flamboyant or bizarre, generally that is the product of female choice. And I find this fascinating because it basically, female choice was revived in about, started to be revived about 30, 40 years ago, and is now a very active area of study. But what's fascinating is we still don't really know why females are choosing certain males. You know, there's lots of theories about it. You know, are they choosing for good genes, or is it just purely an aesthetic choice? And these arguments are extensions of the argument that's been going on since Darwin's time. But yeah, I mean, things like, you know, the proboscis monkey's ridiculous pendulous nose or the peacock's tail. These are all the products of female choice. And I spent some time in the mountains of Northern California in the winter, in the snowdrifts, observing the sage grouse, which has a courtship behavior that is the product of female choice that is amongst the most bizarre things you've ever seen in your life. So the males, they're like about the size of a turkey, and they've got these extraordinary white fan tails, but then they've also got these throat sacs that they can inflate that burst forth like sort of nippleless shock dummy breasts from their chest out of these white feathers, like it was going boop, and then they make this sort of doink noise at the same time. So they're sort of like, they're kind of like dancing to their own body popping beat. I mean, it's like, you're literally like, evolution, what were you thinking? Like, what on earth, females, what are you choosing, ladies? What is it? How did you manage to shape that? But it was fascinating because Gail Patricelli, who's been studying this behavior for like 10 years, she's managed to infiltrate it by creating a robot female sage grouse. It's just amazing. It's on wheels. And it's like this taxidermy stuffed bird. She drives it into the lek amongst all these body popping males where they're all showing off, trying to attract a female. And was able to sort of really kind of like decode this sort of black box of female choice. It's her view that there's no one thing that females are choosing, that basically the males are having to do something that's very energetically demanding. And so by choosing a male who's, you know, because this doing this strut and this beatboxing requires a lot of energy. And so by doing that, they're choosing the best genes for their young. But what she's also discovered, which is really fascinating, is that it's not just a question of the best male wins. What she found out is that the males have to listen to the females and respond to subtle cues that they're making. Otherwise, they won't get to mate. So it's a dialogue. It's not just a sort of, you know, the best male wins, which is the standard, you know, like, I mean, you twitch on any natural history documentary, like The Mating Game that was on recently, the big BBC natural history. And all I can talk about is males will compete and the best male wins. It's not that simple. The males have got to listen to the females and it's not just as simple as, well, certainly the case of the sage grouse and also the bowerbird, which Gail Patricelli has studied in, and it's also been found in spiders as well. So, you know, this idea that females are passive is slowly being broken down, even in that case, which is gratifying.
So, I mean, this exchange, as you said, so listening and responding and, you know, that is continuously happening between the females and males. This is somehow also reflected in the development of genitalia. You also go through that in the book, that there was this focus of male genitalia for many years. Everybody was focusing on the penis, and then basically female genitalia was just imagined like a hollow tube, and passively, as you say, also in the behavior, also physically just doing nothing, egg is waiting there, you know. But this is also not the case, right?
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought this up, because this is one of my favorite stories. It's just amazing, really. So yeah, there's this idea of female passivity, just as you say, it extended towards female morphology, that genital anatomy, you know, and that we were just considered to be passive tubes that the received sperm. But there's a woman called Patricia Brennan who's at Mount Holyoke in Massachusetts, and she's just the most amazing scientist, and she's been described as scientifically unstoppable, and she really is. She's just a sort of extraordinary character, and she is the first person really to look inside a female and just, you know, to see what is going on with female anatomy. And specifically, she was interested in birds. And there's a few groups of birds, the most ancient lines of birds, that still have penises. Most birds just have both sexes have a cloaca, but In the case of some birds, they have penises. And boy, do they have penises. So I've got extraordinary penises. I mean, they're longer than, in the case of the Argentinian lake duck, it's actually like longer than the bird itself when it's fully extended. And not only that, it's corkscrew, right? I mean, it's an extraordinary organ. And for years, male scientists have waxed lyrical about the extraordinary length of the duck penis. I mean, it must just be a product of this male competition. And because regrettably, you know, you get duck mating happens in two ways. One, a female will choose her mate through sort of a rigorous courtship routine. But a lot of the males that don't get chosen end up forming groups and then will sexually coerce females in groups. And it's a really unpleasant thing if you see it. It's really horrible. Females are sort of flapping away and they're being kind of sexually coerced by these males. And so the idea was that, you know, this incredibly long penis had evolved as a result of these sexually coercive acts, and the longest male penis was the one that was fertilizing the egg, and that's what drove its length. Well, Patricia Brennan was like, yeah, very interesting, the male penis, it certainly is extraordinary, but has anybody checked out what kind of garage he's parking his car in? That's her actual word. She's so brilliant. And she found that actually the female, rather than being a passive tube, actually had a similarly extraordinary vagina, and that it was labyrinthine and full of these blind pockets. And actually, when the male the male duck penis isn't like a mammal penis, it actually spends its life unfurled inside the cloaca, a bit like a sort of a coiled up sock, and then it's inflated at high speed with lymphatic, a bit like a sort of party hooter. You know, you get a party hooter at parties, and so it sort of shoots out with party hooter. But and so this penis would get caught in the blind pockets and unfurl back on itself, and so basically the female has evolved a system of blocking the male penis, and so that was actually what's driven the length. So And this explains why the coercive acts of sex result in so few fertilizations, which had been a sort of mystery to scientists up until this point. And so Brennan has rescued the female from being a victim, not only of sexual coercion, she's still that, but of losing the autonomy of who fertilizes her egg. And in evolutionary terms, that's the thing that matters. So actually now she's now a winner in the evolutionary arms race. So, and this idea of conflict between the sexes has shaped a lot of female behavior and morphology.
Isn't it so interesting that at the same time we discuss a lot about the pressures for natural selection, yet let's say roughly half of the animals we just think of passively and not adapting to anything?
I mean, it is. It's ludicrous, really, when you say it out loud. But I mean, that's what's generally thought. I mean, it's still considered widely that males are just more variable than females. And what that means in evolutionary terms is that males are effectively more evolved, because variation is the grit that drives evolution forward. So if females don't vary and we're all the same, then we're not invited to the evolutionary party because we're too boring. You know, I mean, it's absolute lunacy. But yet these old canards persist.
Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com.
newbooks.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So, and then even in cases, so for example, you have a chapter on sexual cannibalism. So even in the cases where the female is bigger and even eats her mate, I also realize that there's a lot of negative connotation of this, like femme fatale and this, like horrible and so on, whereas the males are regarded as, you know, heroes and the bigger ones, biggest antlers and so on. So, but at the end, again, if we look at the science, there's a reason for this cannibalism as well. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is something that, you know, Darwin himself wrote about and noted that it existed. It was sort of some, there's some hilarious bits in The Descent of Man of his sort of horrified, you know, this sort of male zoologist who'd written to him was completely appalled by the fact that this enormous female was eating males in the case of spiders. Sexual cannibalism is rife amongst spiders. I didn't actually realize myself until writing this book that when you see a spider web with a big spider in the middle of it, that's almost always a female, because it's only really the females who build the webs. So males are sort of these sort of small, tiny, in comparison, often like, you know, 125 times smaller in the case of the golden orb weaver spider. And the males are really just sort of mobile sacks of sperm. They often don't have fangs or venom, and they're, and you know, their mission in life is to mate, you know, as is the females. But she just, she has a lot of time on her hand because she lives for many years. So she's often, her priorities aren't quite the same. She might be in the mood for mating, but it might be that she wants to fasten herself up so she can develop more eggs. And so you have, again, as with the ducks, you have this conflict of interest, you see. And it's that these evolutionary arms races are just the most glorious things because they produce such extraordinary outcomes. So in the case of spiders, you have, you know, a tiny little male who wants to mate. You have a female who's much bigger, who's not, maybe wants to mate, maybe doesn't. But she definitely wants to, she may want to eat her mate, you know. And so, so she, in order to, for the male to stop being eaten by the female, they've evolved all these extraordinary tactics. So often males will bring the female, you know, like a sort of the equivalent of a box of chocolates, a sort of dead fly that's wrapped up in silk. Sometimes they'll engage in threesomes, so they'll wait until the female's mating with another spider, and then they'll nip in there and join in. Sometimes they'll tie the female up with silken threads to try and immobilize her so she can't eat him. I mean, they're sort of fantastic, kind of quite sort of kinky repertoire of sexual acts. But this whole idea of sexual cannibalism was horrifying to male scientists. And, you know, it sort of really sort of, you know, it destroyed the natural order of this incredibly dominant, sexually promiscuous female. But, it, you know, it makes perfect sense, because actually the male, although he may have lost his life and be consumed by the female, at least he has fertilized the eggs, and his own body is nourishing the eggs. In fact, there's this brilliant scientist, Eileen Hebbets, who's done a study where she's fed females male spiders of the same species and the equivalent amount of protein from flies, and found that the female spiders gain more weight from eating their species. And so, you know, there's something uniquely nutritious about cannibalism that benefits her eggs. So, you know, and it's one of these things, it seems very tantalizing, but, you know, actually the females are just being assiduously maternal. They're not these sort of dangerous, sexy creatures. They're just being good mums, you know. And funnily enough, the dads that are getting eaten, the males that are getting eaten, are just being good dads as well. It's good parenting, as wild as it seems.
Yeah, indeed. And there's also a lot of studies that you cite about motherhood and also parenting, because this is also one of the concepts that are very much, you know, put in one box, one type of mother. It's caring and nourishing. But in nature, there has been so many ways for both parents actually to take care of their young.
Absolutely. You know, that's, again, it's another one of Darwin's, you know, beliefs, was that, you know, all females are imbued with this maternal instinct. And so I was really interested in exploring that because, you know, I love frogs, right? They're my favorite animal. I've always been obsessed with frogs. And I know very well that male frogs are a candidate for nature's best dad. You know, and they like, they, you know, you get these male frogs that are extremely nurturing over their young. So, for example, poison dart frogs, the males, they don't lay their eggs in ponds, but the males will carry the tadpoles around on their back, and you know, and in other cases they'll care for them and protect them, and the female just lays the eggs and goes off, you know. So this is really fascinating to me, and it turns out amazingly that this extraordinary Stanford associate professor Lauren O'Connell's actually looked inside the brains of frogs and established that there's this neural architecture for nurturing, and it's exactly the same in males and females, and it's basically a switch for parenting. So this mythical maternal instinct actually exists in the brains of males and females. And, you know, she's found it in frogs, but Catherine Dulac has found the same neural architecture in mice. And she's a Harvard professor, and she's very confident that you'd find the same thing in humans. So, you know, I think that's really gratifying for men to discover that, we all have this nurturing instinct. And of course, you know, there's, in addition to that, with female mammals, oxytocin has a big part to play in nurturing as well. But both these cases, with this switch for parenting and with oxytocin, they're not something that you're born with and you instantly feel, that they need these instincts need to be triggered. And so I think that's really helpful, because for a lot of women, you know, friends of mine that have struggled with various elements of motherhood, you know, you can be, there's a lot of guilt and shame involved in feeling like you don't find it natural. Well, it's just that naturally it's something that progresses slowly and in baby steps, as it were. So, you know, I felt really, that was a very important message to come across, but also just one that's really nice to know that males and females are both capable of great parenting.
Yeah, and at the same time, this is, again, let's say we have this in our society as a misconception that, you know, mothers, they devote their lives, it's such a happy thing, and it's so easy to raise a kid, and it's easy to do it even with two parents. I actually think that it's pretty hard. It takes a village, is definitely true, and I was quite happily surprised to find that this is also indeed the case in animal kingdom, that it also takes a village.
Absolutely. I mean, particularly in the case of primates, you know, because we have these extraordinary brains, and so we need, you know, that, you know, babies take a long time to reach independence, and so it is something that is in many cases is a shared activity. So, and what's fascinating, I think, is just all the different ways that you have that sharing that load. You know, so in some cases you'll have monogamous partnerships. You know, like the owl monkey, for example, it's a male and female that are devoted together and will share the load. But in other cases, you have these sort of wonderful innovations, like the black and white rough lemurs, which I visited in Madagascar, where the females, they build these nests like birds high up in the canopy, because with Madagascar, it's a very sort of boom or bust environment. You know, you might have no rainfall for years, and so the trees will do these abundant fruiting episodes, and then there's this sort of boom of food. And so the primate, the lemurs, which are primates that feed on these black and white rough lemurs, they'll respond by having litters, which is very unusual, because normally primates just have the one baby at a time, because, you know, they have such a long development. And they manage this by building these nests high up in the trees, and which act as creches. So the females will one female or not only just females, males as well, maybe like the nurse that looks after the creche for the day while the females go off and feed and do the day job, which is to find food. to make milk and raise the babies. So, you know, there's all these different ways that that females have, in the case of primates, have found the help that they needed. And so, yeah, the idea that it's something that can be managed alone is not really realistic.
And then I would really also like to touch upon, this was in the last chapter where you mentioned actually rainbows in evolution, just like these, biases, like how a female is and a male is in the human society, so in our own society, heteronormative values and understanding of sexuality has also unfortunately plagued the whole scientific understanding in animals. So, and you also mentioned a lot of researchers, one of which is actually John Rofgarden. And can you tell us a little bit what has she found, and catch up a little bit on what we have lost all those years ignoring this diversity in sexuality?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I found this, you know, for me was the most sort of revelatory part of the research in the book, because Darwin's, you know, stereotypes or way of viewing the world focuses on these differences between the sexes, and we have this assumption that reproduction or behavior is all just is a male and a female. But of course, in the animal kingdom, there's just an enormous variety of sexual expression. I mean, it's absolutely glorious, and it sort of defies binary expectations. So, you know, you have a huge amount of animals that are both male and female. And then, as Darwin himself studied in the barnacles, the difference is there's this sort of gradation between hermaphrodite creatures, which are both sexes, to separate sexes. You actually have, you know, in the case of barnacles, and he spotted this, you can see the evolution, the stages from hermaphrodite through to separate sex. And biologists today struggle with the terminology for how do you describe these in between. It's like proto male or we don't have the language to describe it. And so, you know, there really is an extraordinary diversity out there. And of course, there's all sorts of animals that will switch sex within their lives as well. So one of the most fascinating studies for me is Justin Rhodes, who studies anemone fish. And he's very interested in it from what goes on in the brain, right? Because anemone fish, you have, everybody knows them, Finding Nemo, a little orange and white clownfish. They live in an anemone, and you get a male and a female, and the female's dominant. So she's the bigger one of the two. And then you often have like some sort of immature males in the group as well. And when the dominant female is removed, the male that was her partner changes sex and becomes female, and one of the immature males becomes her partner. And so this transition enables Justin to study the feminization of the brain, which is also, guess what, being considered a passive process, which is absolutely extraordinary, the idea that the development of a female brain would be passive, you know, but that's what was believed, that it just sort of passively, females just sort of passively develop in the absence of testosterone. So this is, you know, as he says, this is an opportunity to study this. And what he's found with the anemone fish, which is just totally fascinating to me, is that the transition happens very quickly in terms of behavior. So the female, as soon as the dominant female is removed, the male that is turning into a female starts behaving as a female almost immediately and is recognized as a female by the other fish. But the gonads take up to a year to catch up with the brain. So the brain happens first and the gonads catch up later. So, you know, this is sort of really fascinating because it shows how, you know, sexual identity and sex behavior or even, you know, can be uncoupled from biological sex, and that these sort of not necessarily concur with one another. even in a fish. So I found that really fascinating. And it also just goes to show, you know, what I was sort of, you know, and the parenting switch, it fits in with this as well, which is, you know, quite a few, you know, Lauren O'Connell and David Cruz, you know, scientists talk to me about how, you know, really males and females are much more alike than we are different. You know, we've been looking for these sort of radical differences in our brains and for decades and not found them, you know, and basically male and female brains are more or less the same. So, you know, I think for that was like the greatest revelation for me. I actually had to ask them several times, you know, there's not really that, you know, there's some differences in the brains of male and females, but they're really small. And we don't have this sort of male brains are from Mars and females are from Venus. This idea is tantalizing, but simply not true. And I think that, you know, that was the most sort of empowering revelation, really, because it means that you know, we're equal, you know, that the equality is available, basically.
Yeah, and I mean, now if we can maybe discuss a little bit, so this is what happened. Unfortunately, there was these biases. The scientists have projected these things across sexuality, reproduction, development, and evolution in general. Now, if we think, okay, we now realize this, what can we do? What should be done now to make sure that, let's say, future studies are with an objective lens, they're including variety of different sexualities, different behaviors, without, you know, having the scientists' own belief system and values. So what can we do about this now?
Well, I think that we all need to be aware of bias, you know, and I think that's increasingly the case, and that we all have bias. I mean, I'm biased. My book is biased. You know, I'm telling a different story, you know, but I see the world through a certain lens, and we all do to a certain extent. So, I think it's recognizing and being aware of bias is really important. And of course, you know, the more diversity we have in science, the more voices and the more perspectives, the better science will be. Because as we said at the start of this conversation, you know, science comes from questions, and one asks questions that are close to your heart, or you're interested in your perspective. And so by having a diversity of cultures, genders, sexualities, and, you know, not just sexes amongst science, is definitely going to make our understanding of the natural world less biased.
So also from the scientist perspective, right? So having also different scientists, because this is also even an issue, female scientists, non-binary scientists getting funding or getting, you know, support for their research. So it goes both ways, also from people with different voices than the dominant one, as well as the topics.
Yeah, I mean, there's still, the LGBTQ community are still massively underrepresented in science, and there's a big drop-off rate as well. So, which is, you know, we need to nurture and value alternative perspectives. And, you know, I mean, I think certainly, you know, females are still underrepresented in science, and I mean, there's still this idea that you know, females aren't as good at science, you know, that somehow our brains are different and we don't understand scientific process in the same way. I mean, it's rubbish, you know, it's just, there's no evidence to support this idea, but it's just a really popular myth. And, you know, you've got to sort of wonder why these myths that sort of put females down are so popular when science is still dominated by men. I mean, you know, there's a lot of, in zoology and evolutionary biology, you have a lot of women going into the science, but of course those top positions are still, you know, very, it's male heavy when you get to the very top. So, you know, we need to find a way of addressing that. And, you know, just valuing women and, you know, and all perspectives, as much as male opinion.
Thanks a lot for that. In closing, I want to ask you, I looked up basically while reading all of the animals, how they looked, like searching duck penises, you know, on the internet, and also watching spiders doing their mating dance in the backdrop of Staying Alive and so on. So is there going to be a TV show based on the book is my question.
Oh, well, I am in conversation with a couple of different networks. I mean, I think it would be a glorious thing because, you know, there's as you say, there's so many great visual stories, and there's a lot of the scientists I met, hugely engaging and really charismatic people with great stories to tell. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's a, you know, I produced documentaries for many years, and to me, there's very obviously a really terrific and much needed series, because I end up shouting at the television now, but it's because I feel like it's just the same old stories just told again and again and again, and it's always from the male perspective. So, you know, it would be a wonderful thing. So, fingers crossed. Watch this space. I'm working on it, basically.
I will, and I'll be the first to watch it, really. I also think this would be very interesting. It would also be very nice to put the faces to the names, also with regards to scientists and also many animals that you describe in the book. So thanks a lot, Lucy, for joining us today. It has been a wonderful discussion and a great, great book. I actually recommend it to everybody to pick it up if they want to laugh and learn about something while laughing.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that one. It was a really enjoyable conversation. Thank you.